Hello and welcome to Untouched, the podcast from the Centre for Visual Cultures at Royal Holloway, University of London. In this podcast series, we will be delving into the themes of touch, tangibility and intangibility in engagements with art on an everyday basis, on trips to galleries, in curatorial practice, in artistic creation and in academic research. We will be asking what it means to physically interact with visual culture, what we can get from non-visual engagements with art, how the pandemic has changed our approach to artistic interplay, and what happens when we encounter the intangible and the unknown. I'm Anna Price, a doctoral researcher and research centre associate here at the CVC, and today I will be talking to Kate Tren, the curator at the River and Rowing Museum. Welcome and thank you so much for joining us on this inaugural episode of the RHUL Centre for Visual Cultures podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm honoured to be here and talking with you today.
Very excited to have you on. First of all, can you just introduce yourself a little bit and tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so my name is Kate. I am the curator at the River and Rowing Museum in Henley-on-Thames. I'm fairly new to the role. This is actually my first sort of curatorial position that I've ever had. So it's been a very steep learning curve, but I am just thoroughly enjoying myself. In terms of background, I actually got this job. I was introduced to the museum because I was actually volunteering on the project that we're going to be talking about today. So that's sort of how I got my start. So it's a subject that's very close to my heart. But yeah, I'm loving every second of it.
And what is the River and Rowing Museum about? What's your collection like?
Well, it does what it says on the tin. It's the River and Rowing Museum, so you get a good idea of what we've got. We've got five main galleries, and they very much align with our five themes of collecting. So we have the Rowing Gallery, which is obviously about the history, the international history of the sport of rowing. We've got the River Gallery, which looks at how people have interacted with the Thames and other rivers as well, not just the Thames. As well as a little bit about the sort of the ecology of it and the science of how rivers work. We have the John Piper Gallery, which is an exhibition on the works of John Piper, who was a local artist in the 20th century, a very prolific. He tried nearly every single genre of art. So he is a fascinating subject. And we have the Henley Gallery, which is obviously about the history of the town and significant people in it. And then lastly, we also have our Wind in the Willows experience, which is a lovely 3D model sort of experience telling you the story of the Wind in the Willows. It's got great sort of soundtrack, soundscapes, music. It's fun for all ages.
It's amazing. And so within these galleries, you display objects, artwork, documents, mm-hmm. everything and everything.
We have got, like you say, anything and everything really in our collection. We have ranging from sort of 60-foot racing shells to tiny trophies for rowing. We've got art, like you say, with John Piper, but we've also got a beautiful Seabrex painting. Yeah, we just it's a very varied collection, and I think we're only displaying about 20% of wow. what we've got really. We've just got so much that could be talked about.
And so moving on to the collections project then, mm-hmm. Which I think has been in operation since May 2021, is that correct?
Yes.
So what is the process of the collections project, and also what's its purpose? What are you aiming to achieve with it?
Yeah, so the collections project is essentially dedicated to auditing every single object that we have in our collection. We've got to look at the condition of every object. We have to look at where it's located and any discrepancies there may be between what we see visually and what is recorded on our system. And I guess it was sort of born out of a need by my predecessor to address a host of historic documentation issues that we have, as most museums tend to have. I think documentation issues are fairly common, but we were also sort of running out of storage space, and so it was becoming quite a pressing need to take a look at every single object and make sure we actually knew what we had. So, I mean, the process itself is fairly simple, really. It's taking an object out of storage, giving it a condition check, looking at the record that we have on the system for it, and just, yeah, like I say, looking for discrepancies and correcting those discrepancies where we can. I think a lot of the correcting is going to take place after the project, because there will be a lot of very common issues that extend across lots of other objects, so it makes sense to just do it all at once. I think the best way to explain why it's important is to talk about the number of objects in our collection, because we initially thought going into the project that we had 25,000 objects in the collection, which is a very respectable number of objects. So since May 2021, we have done, we think, about half of what we have in the collection, and we've already reached 20,000 objects.
Wow.
So yeah, we're pushing that estimate now. It's probably more likely going to be 30 to 35,000, maybe beyond that.
So do you think the collections project will change the way that the museum is kind of operating at the moment? Like, what stead will it stand the museum in moving forward?
I think we're definitely taking this as an opportunity to redefine what our documentation process is, clarifying it, making sure that it is adhered to with every single object and that there are no exceptions. Because I think that is where these issues are born from, is when you have people working from different rule books. And I think it's just, it's turning our focus sort of inwards a little bit. We've been very outward focused in terms of putting on great exhibitions and have sort of let these things fall by the wayside a little bit. So I think our focus at the minute and the way that we're going to be sort of treating our collection in the future is starting from the sort of the smallest thing, making sure that we have the foundation correct and right and working, so that we can then build upon that to put on great exhibitions.
Absolutely, that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, your collections hold more than artworks and visual culture, but that is what we're going to focus a little bit on today. And just in terms of the collections project, I've been thinking quite a lot about the dichotomy inherent in the systematic organization of works that are considered to be creative and born out of creative expression. You know, as a researcher, I often have to approach archival research or even gallery visits in a really organized way for it to be kind of efficient and effective with plan of action, so I can get the most out of the visits. And I often wonder if this sort of systemized approach affects my interaction with the artworks and visual culture, as I perhaps forget about the more organic and creative origins of the art. And I just wonder, from a curator's perspective, if you have any thoughts on this.
It's a really interesting question, and it's something that I didn't anticipate going into this sort of career, because I think people who go into curatorial or archival work care a lot about objects and art and visual culture. They care about what they are and what they represent. But I think once you're in it as a job, it becomes a job, doesn't it? As does anything. And I think it's very easy as a curator to start thinking about the objects in our collection as the product of a business. You know, when you look at it like that, in a very organized, systematic way, like you say, you start thinking about a painting as an accession number. You think about it as a set of environmental conditions that need to be met. You think about it as its insurance value. You're not thinking about it as, you know, an object to be appreciated as art. You're not thinking about it as its creative process. And I think a lot of that stems from just looking at the objects on your collection system, your collections management system, seeing them on your screen, seeing them as like as a picture on your screen, or not spending time with the objects themselves. So I think that's what the collections project has really given us, is an opportunity to spend time with our collection and look at it in person and actually be with it. Because like I say, a lot of it is in storage, it's not on display. So, you know, I'm intimately familiar with the stuff that we've got on display, but the stuff that's in storage is kind of easy to forget about, because you're not seeing it every day. So I think being able to be with the objects, and you're spending a lot of time looking at them, condition checking them, just kind of staring at them for a little bit, you get to interact with them on a sort of a deeper level that you didn't necessarily get before. And I think it helps reawaken that understanding that it's something beyond just a canvas with some paint on it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really interesting side effect to the original aim, to which it was to be organized and systematic, mm-hmm. and that you're getting back to the roots of your enjoyment of the art through that way. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that before. So leading on from that, the physical interaction that you're having with the artworks, I think another side of that is visibility, invisibility, and accessibility. And your collections project is in a way happening behind closed doors, in the fact that it's not a public-facing activity. Will you be making any changes to the permanent displays as a result of the collections project? You know, has there been an item or piece of artwork that you've come into contact with that has had quite a profound impact on you and that you think will enhance visitor experience?
Yeah, I think it's definitely in our nearish future to do some pretty big changes to our permanent displays. A lot of what's on display at the minute has been on display for a very long time.
Yes.
And we're not only concerned in terms of a visitor experience point of view, and that you're not really inviting repeat visits by just having the same thing on display every time. But it's also, there's a lot of objects that need a rest from display. Not everything needs to be on display for, you know, 20 years in a row. They need to be away from light levels. They need to be away from public contact, you know. So a lot of that is prompting a need for a change in display. And I think the collections project has also sort of just brought that to the front of our minds. We've realized how much stuff we've got and how many stories we've got to tell. And you know, there's so much that we can do with it. So I think what we've realized is that it would be completely viable for us to move forward with a model of having rotating displays that can rotate on a 6-monthly basis, on a yearly basis, however, you know, however frequently we want to change them. But we can have a few, maybe 50% being sort of permanent, always there displays, our best things that should always, you know, that tell the stories, you know, the best. But then we also want to sort of cycle through everything else that we've got in our collection and pick on different themes, and they can be, you know, in line with current events, or they can be, you know, just anything that we think is really interesting. And I think one of the things that has really sort of sparked inspiration with me is our history of early women's rowing, because we've got a great display at the minute on modern women's rowing, with sort of people who've become household names like Helen Glover and people like that. But we actually have a wonderful collection of photographs of two separate women's rowing clubs that both started in the late 1920s. And they're just photos of the women on this team being successful, winning trophies, winning medals, being really successful in their field, but also just having that camaraderie and that team spirit, and just wonderful pictures of these women just being friends and you know, going on trips together and things like that. And that's just something that I really want to pick out in our collection, because it's just not really on display at the minute. I think there's maybe like passing mentions of the fact that women were involved in the sport as early as the 1920s, but there's just so much more that we can pick out there. And I think that's something that I really want to do a big re-display of, just to remind people that women have been involved in rowing for a very long time.
Yeah, they have. Absolutely. That's been apparent in my research as well, from the late 1800s, which is really interesting. I think it's really great that you want to showcase that as well. And I think it's, I guess the collections project has allowed the museum to really take stock and to want to be forward thinking in that way. And I guess it's really good that the aim moving forward is now to reveal the collections to the public and to gain that public interest in a perpetual way. As a volunteer on your collections project, I've seen a little bit firsthand the expansive nature of your collections in terms of the variety of visual mediums and visual culture. So, you know, from painting, sketches, illustrations, photographs, and I believe you also have video footage as well. What do you think visitors get from this variety of visual culture?
I think it being such a specific focus for a museum, you know, it's not just a sports museum, it's a rowing museum sort of fundamentally. As well, it's obviously collecting other themes, but that was the purpose, that was why the museum kind of started, was to be a location for the history of rowing. And that's something that's quite inaccessible to a lot of people. A lot of people don't particularly care about rowing. They don't, you know, they might not be sports people, but they might specifically not be rowing people. They might not think it's something that relates to them in any way. And I think having a massive variety in our mediums in our collection and it just is something for everyone. There's, if you're somebody who likes art, we've got plenty of art. If you're interested more in the science of how the rowing boats are created, you know, the advancements in technology, we've got that. We've got literally something for anyone. And I think that's, it allows people to, particularly in regards to rowing, to feel a little bit more welcome to it, I guess. They might arrive and think, you know, this is probably not going to be for me, but after you've been here for a couple hours and you've looked at everything that we've got on display, you're like, oh, actually, I've had an interesting time. I've learned something new and I've been able to engage with something because I really like, I don't know, I like metalwork and I'm interested in how the trophies were designed, things like that.
Absolutely. That's great that that a sport such as rowing, which is often considered to be quite exclusive, can be made accessible via the visual culture and the visual mediums. Is there a challenge in curating kind of these multiple elements of visual culture in a gallery space? You know, what are the practicalities of having a video alongside a sculpture, alongside a photograph? And does this cause friction with the story that you're trying to tell?
I think there's definitely an element of challenge to it. I think it, in terms of the sort of the practicality and logistics, just how you design a space to accommodate all of these different kinds of mediums, having the right AV equipment for displaying videos, that kind of thing, all of that's a challenge, but that's relatively easy to overcome. I think the most difficult challenge is getting the sort of the scope and the balance of it correct. Mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult to make the transitions between the mediums kind of seamless and you know, for example, if you've got a video up against a painting and they're both talking about the same thing, it can be really difficult to make them seem connected because they're so visually different. Mm. And I think when you can make that transition seamless, whether that's through the way it's displayed or whether it's through the interpretation around it that helps guide the visitor to see those connections, once you can do that, you're encouraging people to sort of see it from a completely different perspective. I think having it's definitely more, when you can rise to meet that challenge, it's more of a benefit to an exhibition than anything else, because when you can play those differences off each other, because sometimes the differences are what allow you to see, like I say, see it from a new perspective. So I think it's definitely something I want to use more of, because we've got some sort of videos on display and I think we can do more with it. I think we can develop it a little bit more and use those differences to come up with something really interesting.
And we've talked a little bit about how on the project you're able to be with the objects and to engage with it physically. But this is a privilege that you have as a curator or a gallerist can have, or an archivist or myself as a researcher, that we can be with the artwork. And I was wondering what physical touch can tell us about a piece of artwork, and what do you personally get out of it, and how can we replicate this experience for visitors when objects are behind glass and they're not physically accessible to them?
You're right, it's definitely a privilege. I think it's the thing that anyone who works in this field is excited about going into it, is, you know, being able to touch history. And now I realize that you shouldn't actually touch history and you should definitely wear gloves, but you get what I mean, being able to physically be with history and heritage and art is just such an exciting thing. And I think is particularly with art, I think being able to have that sort of physical experience with art lets you connect with the artist in a different level. I think when you're just, you know, standing in a gallery looking at a piece of art that's in front of you behind some glass or behind a rope barrier or something like that, it's a very physical barrier between you and the artist. It's the artist is telling you something and you're there to listen to it, or the curator is telling you something and you're there to listen to it. But I think when you get to be that close to art, I guess you feel closer to the artist as being another human, especially, like, I mean, just physical closeness, being able to see brush strokes and things like that, mm-hmm. just opens that experience to you, and you realize that, you know, that was an actual person who made this. It's not just been printed from a computer or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think the last step of the collections project is going to be looking at our handling collection, previously, I think the Handlin collection has been really used by sort of the education team, using it in school visits and things like that. But I really want to develop the Handlin collection, because I think there's something there with making it more accessible to the visitor by being able to be that close to objects. I think there's also a really interesting conversation to be had, and I'm not sure what it would look like, but it's something I want to help sort of develop and talk about a bit more, is the idea of sort of replicating physical processes. I think you see it a lot in archaeology, in sort of physical processes like that, where, you know, you go to a museum and they show you how they struck a coin. And we have it in the museum with, we've got a rowing simulator that lets you pull on the oars, and you get to, there's someone calling out the strokes to you and everything. And that, there's something so special about being able to physically replicate that process. And I want to know if, I feel like there's something that we can do there with more with the visual culture side of it, rather than the sort of the sport side of it. I think there really is something that we can develop and build on there. I don't know what it looks like, but I want to explore that a little bit more, because I'm somebody who learns more by doing than reading. And I think that would really help people connect with it a little bit more if they can do art rather than just view it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so interesting. And I think just moving on a little bit from that, it's kind of thinking about the people who engage with art in a non-visual way, as you're saying, perhaps in a physical way or in an audio way. And at the moment, does the River and Rowing Museum do anything to facilitate this non-visual interactions? I know you mentioned the rowing simulator, mm-hmm. but in terms of the artwork and the very visual mediums.
So at the minute, I think that's probably our biggest gap. And it's something that I want to definitely develop. But I think the closest thing that we really have to that is our audio guide that goes with the Wind and the Willows experience, because mm-hmm. that helps to tell the story. And also, I mean, the experience itself, you know, there's a moment where you're going into the winter section of it, and there's some cold air that blasts at you, and there's, you know, soundscapes of the forest or you know, badger snoring really loudly. All of that really helps to connect with it on a different level. I really want to develop our sort of audio approach, both in terms of accessibility. I think it's so important, but it's also helps people who don't need it in terms of accessibility. Making it sort of like a multi-sensory experience can just improve people's understanding just so far beyond what you currently have, if that makes sense. So yeah, it's something that we definitely need to improve upon.
Yeah, definitely. And continuing along the lines of kind of like the unseen, are there any gaps in your collection? I know we've talked about how vast it is, but are there any gaps or unknowns that you've established through your project?
And we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier. I think our biggest gap is kind of social history in Henley. We have a lot about the kind of the elite in Henley. Mm-hmm. It has a reputation. Henley and rowing have a reputation for being kind of upper middle class, very, you know, very elite sort of spaces. But that wasn't always the case for Henley as a town. It started as an inland port. We have a little bit, but we definitely don't have enough to like do a whole exhibition about, for example. So I really want to develop that part of our collection, because I think that'll just help people feel a bit more welcome. I think it you know, it just improves accessibility for people who don't see themselves currently represented in Henley.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. It would definitely improve the inclusivity of the town itself. Amazing. So moving on to thinking about the museum space, during the pandemic, the concept of an online exhibition became a new element in considerations of visual culture, of seeing art through a screen. And some institutions kind of used this medium as a placeholder until people could come back in person. And others, I've noticed, have factored this into their programming and their kind of like perpetual online presence. What pros and cons do you envisage with online exhibitions? And I don't know if the River and Rowing Museum put on any online exhibitions, and I was just wondering how that went for the museum.
So, I mean, I only joined the museum in 2021, so kind of post-lockdown side of the pandemic. But I know that my predecessor did do a few videos that were like tea with the curator, and she would like sit down with a cup of tea and talk about interesting parts of the collection. But I think I agree with you. Online exhibitions are something that I think should be in every kind of permanent programming, because they are so much more inclusive for people who don't necessarily have access to the museum. I think they're a great way, especially if you're a museum that has a admissions charge. I think they're a really great way to interact with people and still get your message across and still interact with your community, especially if people can't necessarily afford to visit museums on a regular basis. I think they're a great way to help interact. They're also great for people who have accessibility issues or just don't live in this country. You know, not everybody who is interested in rowing lives in the UK. So I think I really want to develop our online sort of presence. We're in the process of developing a new website, and I definitely want to put together some more sort of online presence for our curatorial messages, just because I think it's a different way to interact with it, because you can put things on display that can't necessarily go on physical display if they're too fragile or too large. We've got some things that are really large and difficult to display, but if we can do that online.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something really interesting that you touched on there, and the fact that online is a distinct gallery space to the in-person kind of like physical gallery space, and that you can view it as two separate things instead of having the online as a lesser version. So I think that's definitely really interesting. But thinking about being in a space in person, do you think that visitors engage with art differently post-pandemic? Do they relish the opportunity to be back in a physical gallery space? And, you know, what does it mean to be there to physically absorb the art? Work.
I think it was a reopening post-pandemic was a really nice, there was just a really nice atmosphere. We were very quiet, you know, it was a lot of people still were not feeling comfortable coming out into, you know, public spaces and everything, but the people who were coming back were telling us just how much they've missed being in the spaces themselves, because I think you definitely feel an improvement in people's well-being in that kind of regard of just being back among art, because what we've been talking about this whole time is the sort of physical interaction with it. Being in the same space as something just completely changes your interpretation of it, I think, and your environmental context as well is just so important in how you interpret things and how you engage with things. I think a lot of people who like museums find museums to be very comforting spaces, or very inspiring. And I think just being around like-minded people is very refreshing. So yeah, I think people have really enjoyed coming back. I think that's what it is that people just feel more grateful and feel more appreciative of being able to come back and do these things when we went so long without being able to do it.
Absolutely, yeah. And just to finish off, I have a few sort of quick fire questions, as it were.
Yep.
So what is your favourite piece of visual culture in the River and Rowing Museum collection?
So my favourite is definitely, at the minute, I mean, I feel like a bad parent picking a picking a favourite, but at the minute, I'm really loving our Seabrook painting, Henley from the Walgrave Road, because that not only is it a beautiful painting, it has a lot of historical significance, but that's the road that I drive down every day to get into Henley.
Amazing.
And it's just being able to see, it's a very different view now, but it's the same kind of windy road that he's you know, painted to that perspective from, and it's just great seeing that every day.
Absolutely. And what is your favorite piece of visual culture in the world, so outside of your collection?
Contrasting to our collection, I'm a classicist at heart. Uh-huh. And so I would say probably the winged Nike.
Mm-hmm.
She's just beautiful. Every time I look at her, she's just so divine.
Amazing. And what does interacting with art mean to you?
It's easy to fall into cliches.
Yes.
But I think art and culture and heritage, or the whole package, it's what really makes us human. It's mm-hmm. what defines us as humans. And I think just having a job that I could spend my day surrounded by it every day, it's just such a privilege, and I'm just so grateful.
And is there anything that you'd like to promote or make our listeners aware of with regards to the museum and your work there?
It's kind of a watch this space moment at the museum. We're gearing up for some construction projects, so we're going to be having some closures here and there over the next, you know, few months, but all of that is to bring back a fresh feel to the museum. We're going to be doing some redisplays, we're going to be putting some new things out on display, we're going to be doing some potentially some online exhibitions soon as well, like I just said. So yeah, stay tuned. We've got some new things coming.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Kate. Thank you so much for your time and for your really interesting insights from the world of the River and Rome Museum. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me. I've had a lovely time talking.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Untouched. All the information you need to find out more about us, the Centre for Visual Cultures, and about the River and Rome Museum is linked in the episode notes. If you have any thoughts or questions on what we've discussed today, email us at centreforvisualcultures@rhul.ac.uk or tweet us at @rhul_CVC. This podcast is produced by the Royal Holloway Centre for Visual Cultures, located in the Languages, Literatures and Cultures Department at Royal Holloway. Edited and hosted by myself, Anna, with music by Gaspar Senna. See you next time.